It's November 3rd, 2011, and this is the Hell Yeah Show. Hello and welcome to the Hell Yeah Show. I'm Alan.
I'm Avery.
And we are both tired and late this week. This is the Hell Yeah Show, where we give you advice on how to not let technology ruin your day. That's best practices for fail-free living. And Emery, what are we doing this show?
The turbulent teen years. And today we are broadcasting from the Israel Rosenkrantz Memorial Studios.
Indeed. And I actually just found out about this, but a dear online friend passed away. So let's see. We are talking about a variety of mixed bag things this week. Nothing particularly themed or important, but we are entering the turbulent teen years, so I guess it's okay to be a little confused about our identities.
That's true. That's true. I think we're both feeling a little experimental.
All right. Open-minded, ready to give this a shot. So, starting off here, I get to talk about why the show is late this week. It's because
I think you should.
It's because I can't manage my schedule properly. Because on Saturday, I woke up and was bombarded by hundreds and hundreds of messages on my Twitter account.
And you were thinking that the Hell Yeah Show had really taken off.
And I was, oh man, yeah, I was thinking someone overnight discovered the Hell Yeah Show, thought it was genius, and decided to tell all their friends about it. But no. Turns out the Australian airline Qantas decided to ground all of its flights because of a labor dispute. The CEO of Qantas shares the same name as me, Alan Joyce, spelled A-L-A-N-J-O-Y-C-E.
That guy's a dick.
Oh, man, well. So I also happen to own the Twitter account at Alan Joyce. So twitter.com/AlanJoyce, all one word, spelled exactly the same as the Australian CEO. So I woke up to people telling me I was a terrorist, to people telling me I was a terrible CEO, people telling me one person wanted to try and book a cheap flight or something. Bunch of random people trying to contact me, thinking that I am, in fact, this Australian CEO. And so this, I would have expected this. It's happened before on Twitter. I'll get the occasional message that is actually intended for the Australian Alan Joyce. Mm-hmm. But some media organization in Australia picked up the story, and then a bunch of other media organizations in Australia picked up the story about this confused identity thing between me and the CEO, Alan Joyce.
Did you think about changing your avatar to Elmo and start talking about smoking grass like the Netflix?
I thought about pulling a Quickster, yeah. And I had friends suggesting all sorts of interesting things I could do.
I wanted you to start promising flights and upgrades.
Oh, it was great. One person said that they sent me a message that was like, Alan, you know, you should you should send out a message right now saying we've resolved all of the labor disputes. Planes will be back in the air momentarily.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did not do anything like that, for better or for worse. But I did play along a little bit, and this is probably why the media organizations picked this up, is I'd occasionally make a reply and be like, someone who had mistaken me for the CEO and just tell them, correct them in a kind of mocking way, I guess. But
yeah, you commented specifically on the Will Smith.
Will Smith, the for tested.com, reporter for tested.com, he owns the Twitter account at Will Smith, and I'm sure he gets so much of the same type of stuff. So anyway,
hey, he's a fresh prince.
Yes. Yeah. So anyway, I woke up to this on Saturday. Woke up to a bunch of people messaging me saying, hey, you're in the news, and here's a story about you. And then Sunday, I did, I think, 8 or 9 radio interviews for Australian radio stations, right?
Yeah.
I got this flood of emails like for interview requests and whatnot, because I think people are looking for a lighter side to this story.
Sure.
So I get all these interview requests, and then At some point, I think it was on Monday, I did like one or two more interviews on Monday. At Monday, the TV stations start picking up on this. So I get a call from an Australian TV station, which I had not, they sent me an email and I hadn't responded to it yet. But they found my phone number without me actually giving it to them, which was a little
That's
creepy.
Interesting.
Yes. my cell phone number, no less, not like a Google Voice number or anything. I'm guessing that probably I did an interview with a station that was, you know, owned by the same company or something.
That could be.
But anyway, so an Australian morning show, the Channel 7, Sunrise on 7 morning show, contacted me and wanted to do a satellite or, you know, remote interview. And then the
you
local...
Did you ask them if they could, like, fly you out to come in the studio?
Well, so, I mean, they're not going to fly me out just for an interview, right? But...
well, why not?
but there was
I guess
actually,
all the airlines are grounded, though, so why don't
right,
you get
yeah.
there?
there was actually a previous case where someone else owned the Twitter name at The Ashes, and apparently The Ashes is a very popular Australian cricket match. Okay. So, so they got confused for the cricket match, and Qantas actually was peripherally involved because they offered to fly the person out for a big cricket match in Australia.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, Qantas has never had, like, a crash, right? They have a 100% safety record or something?
I remember reading that somewhere, yeah. I think they may be the only major carrier that can say that. I'm not sure. But so they were very nice about it. They contacted me personally and apologized and whatnot. And
really?
Off Twitter, you know, via email.
That's kind of nice. I'm surprised.
Yeah, yeah. And they mentioned something like, we should get you a chance to meet the CEO, Alan Joyce. So I'm not getting my hopes up, but that would be, I'm definitely open to the idea. They want to fly me down to Australia and give me a chance to meet the CEO.
Did you plug the show?
The Hell Yeah Show, only indirectly, only because
it is
on my Twitter feed and website, but did not manage to plug it directly on Australia.
You couldn't
media.
Say like you know well. One thing, Bob, about all of this brouhaha is that it's really impacted my ability to record my podcast.
Oh, I didn't think of that. I didn't think of that.
My co-host, Emery.
I should have said that.
Yeah, you need to like take a couple classes in shameless self-promotion.
Yep. Anyway, and then on Monday, the local CBS Bay Area news contacted me, and they did a story, which you can find online if you really want to. They did a story where they asked me more about the kind of meta, the meta aspects to it of sort of what does this mean with regard to online identities? And,
shut up. What a dumb question.
It's great. I'll find this real quick because it's fantastic. They paraphrased me with this great quote. Let's see. Risk. Yeah, okay. It seems the problem for Stanford's Alan Joyce began with an Australian columnist mistakenly assumed his Twitter handle belonged to the CEO, not the American. The student said, "It's one of the risks we all run in the internet age."
Good quote.
But that's not a direct quote. They paraphrased me there.
Yeah, I would hope. If that was a direct quote, you should probably go jump off a building.
I don't believe I ever used the phrase internet age, but don't plan to at any point ever. So. anyway. It has been quite the experience, though. I did the satellite, actually fiber, remote interview for the morning show on Tuesday morning, and that was quite the trip. Had the earpiece in, was sitting in front of the newsroom at NBC Bay Area at this raised desk, talking into a camera with the bright light and everything. It was interesting. So,
have you? Do you think it's all kind of blown over?
Oh, I think so. At this point, the morning show was the last of the interview requests that I have responded to, and at this point, the Twitter messages are not coming in as frequently. Qantas has their planes back in the air and operating normally now, so not as big of a story anymore.
Rage averted.
Yes, indeed. But that was quite the weekend and quite the few days, and did push back a bit of work, and that's why the Hell Yeah show is happening on Thursday this week instead of Monday.
Did you at least thank them for Yahoo Serious and Paul Hogan?
Those are really the only
two cultural developments that I can, you know, attribute to Australia. And toilets that go the wrong way.
I did see that that you filled in those details on the Hell Yeah Twitter feed, I think it was.
So, yes.
Yes. Very good. Anyway, yeah, that was fun and also ridiculous.
I'm sure. It sounds like it was a little ponderous at times, but I'm glad you made it.
Yeah. All right. We're
happy the angry mob didn't get you.
Yes. Yeah, I'm very happy. And I still get the occasional message where someone just completely cluelessly starts accusing me of taking too much money and...
You scumbag!
Yep. Yep. Okay. So now turning to more serious business topics here. No more lighter side of the news for us here.
Well, in this internet age, Alan, I don't know if you're aware, but there are a lot of cyber criminals.
There are a lot of risks we all run in this internet age, is what you're saying.
Yes, it's important to have vigilance.
Yeah.
And yeah. So there's been a couple of articles lately in particular about foreign governments having agents acting on their behalf who are attempting to steal intelligence or intellectual property from U.S. corporations, U.S. military contractors, things like that. There was a big story a few years ago about Google being targeted in China. I don't know if you remember that or not.
Yeah, I remember that with Gmail. Kind of
Not just Gmail. I mean, it was, you know, Google in general. But yeah, there's always kind of this back and forth and a lot of posturing with various governments about this type of thing. In particular, one that I remember pretty vividly was an outfit that was called the Russian Business Network.
Sounds perfectly legitimate. This is
It was kind of like, you know, at The Simpsons where Fat Tony hangs out at a club called the Legitimate Businessman Social Club.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot like that. But yeah, the RBN was involved with hosting sites for people to distribute malware and things like that. And I mean, rumor has it, and this is a fairly well-regarded rumor, that the person that was kind of responsible for this was somewhat well-connected through the local government there. And, you know, there's a certain element of espionage in these types of matters, I guess,
sure.
Where there's like the RSA compromise where people who make the secure ID tokens were attacked and customers of theirs were subsequently attacked and were able to circumvent those types of controls and get access to things internally. And a lot of times it's, you know, companies like contractors who make things like airlines and fighter jets and military contractors. And then there's also companies like financial institutions and things like that that get targeted specifically for this purpose.
Sure.
So sometimes, you know, there's people that are obviously trying to just get whatever they can get their hands on. And then there's this notion of the advanced persistent threat or APT threat model. And I think most of the time, people who say that they're the victim of an advanced persistent threat, the vast majority of the time, it is not advanced. It is no more persistent than any other attack, but it is a threat. And it's really just a matter of user education and practicing good hygiene to avoid this type of thing.
And you're talking on the scale of large corporations, not necessarily individuals.
No, to be frank, I don't think there's any... Hi, Frank. I don't think there's any difference really between the attacks against home users and the ones against corporate users. I mean, there are people who directly and specifically target people that work at financial institutions and things like that. But the vast majority of people who blame these types of persistent targeted attacks, they're not actually targeting them. I mean, they're targeting them only in that they're sending them the malware and they're trying to get them to click on links. But
right,
they're
falling for it. Yeah.
I mean, there's like especially educational institutions across campuses. There's always lots of phishing attacks.
Yep.
And the goal there is usually to get access to login credentials for email services, so then they can send out, you know, malicious software or links to malicious software and other phishing messages to other people from an address that you might trust.
Right, right.
So, I don't know, like, this whole notion that, like, you know, there's a bunch of people who are specifically going after people, that I'm sure it is happening. I mean, there's evidence to support that, but I also think that it's kind of an overblown threat that a lot of people use as an excuse for poor management.
Right, right.
But, I mean, there's a U.S. report out specifically calling out China and Russia, saying these guys are not doing enough to curb this kind of thing, and we're kind of stuck having to try to explain why this is happening and why these organizations are being targeted. And I mean, the real answer is really because it's there. And I don't know that it's necessarily government operatives. There's the Komodo hacker who took out Diginotar and compromised a subordinate certificate authority of Komodo, and claims to have infiltrated other certificate authorities.
And I forget, do we know who he's affiliated with? Or
he's Iranian.
Okay. Yeah. I remember.
He says that he's. I mean, I don't remember if his or her statements said that they were specifically, like, working on behalf of the Iranian government, but, you know, it was like a very nationalistic, pro-Iranian government message, which, you know, maybe they're the equivalent of a patriot, you know?
Right.
I don't know.
Right.
Yeah. So there's, like, you know, there's this back and forth there, and who's to say that I think in a lot of cases, there's evidence that supports the claim that some governments are not as eager to protect U.S. interests as they are their own, shall we say? And, right. And in particular in China, and especially with regards to copyright, like the vast, like just the sheer numbers of counterfeit goods that come out of China is absolutely staggering. And I don't think anyone could say with a straight face that China takes this problem seriously and is really working diligently to stop counterfeit goods and pirated software. Like,
well, the opposite works to their advantage, so there's not really an incentive for them to do so.
Yeah. I think, like, it wouldn't surprise me if, like, for every copy of Windows 7 running in China, you know, less than 5% of them were purchased. it wouldn't shock me at all.
Sure. Yep. All right. Well, anyway, but on this recent case, Russia and China cyber attacking the U.S., are you concerned about this?
Well, you know, to some extent, yes. The critical infrastructure side of things, like these SCADA networks that we talked about a few episodes ago, for like power plants and things like that, like there is a real threat there. And I don't think that the United States has taken these types of threats seriously. I certainly don't think that the power plants and the regulation boards that are responsible for maintaining this type of thing are doing their part. I mean, some of the stories I've been reading lately about power plants in particular, I mean, they're very soft. Like, right. There's just not a lot of investment there. I mean, even like our nuclear power plants, I guess, you know, most of them were built in like the 1970s. Actually, all of them were built in the 1970s, and they haven't been touched since.
They're not building new ones, yeah.
No, and like the same design from the reactor in Japan that went bananas, like that's probably something that we have here. Just waiting. Like, just there's no sense of urgency about it. There's really not a great deal of focus on infrastructure in the United States.
And particularly when it comes to digital infrastructure.
Yeah, I mean, did you see there was a, gosh, not too long ago, I think it was Time Warner. Some companies, like Network Engineer has a blog, and they were talking about a fire in a, like not something like underground. It was like a, like you'd open up a manhole and you could see like this big tunnel, and it wasn't like an old subway station. I don't remember what it was, but, to make a long story short, there was a big fire underground and it completely fused and melted like this huge mass of fiber. And like, I think they said that there were like 300,000 people affected by it.
Wow. Where was this?
It was in Manhattan.
Okay.
And I'll see if I can dig it up and drop it in the show notes. It's actually like the really cool part about this was looking at this photograph and just looking at how like what a disaster this wiring job is. Because when they pull off like this this manhole cover, right, and they're digging, you peer down into this dark expanse where everyone's like running their fiber and copper everywhere, uh-huh. and it's like half the stuff in there is not even labeled. if I were a line technician or somebody sent out something like this, I don't know how I would cope on a day-to-day basis. I would want to die. Like it was rough. And there's tons and tons of insulation in there. Cause like, I guess, I don't know if in the case of fiber, it's gotta be to keep it warm maybe. Cause if it gets too cold, it'll shatter. Right.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't know what they're insulating against, but there's like,
just that makes it even messier.
Yeah. So it's like, and it looks, I mean, they're like blonde wigs. They look like wigs that are stuffed in there. It's like, yep. This really feathery insulation. So it's a total train wreck. And like, how anything can be found and diagnosed in that type of an environment just boggles the mind. And like, I think a lot of the infrastructure that's being built, I think, is going to end up being rebuilt for especially smaller cities that want to do things like municipal Wi-Fi or like local storage networks, things uh-huh. like that. Like, I think there's probably going to be some real movement there. Google's big data centers that they're putting up everywhere, for example. Yeah, I mean, Google has, what are they, like, the largest source of dark fiber in the United States?
Well, they are, at least around where I am, they're starting to pioneer this free internet for parts of Palo Alto at this point. Or, well, it's parts of the Stanford area. But they're running whatever they run to all of the places where they need to ensure they have very good network connections. They're running that to residential areas now, which is pretty exciting.
Yeah, I mean, there's a neighboring town to me that has really fast multi-megabit fiber. I can't get that in my town, but it's definitely coming. I mean, I told you, like, my grandmother can get the equivalent of Fios, and it's like from her little telco. Like, it's kind of crazy.
Yep, yep.
But yeah, it's interesting, and I think should you worry about it? No, I mean, you can't really do anything about it. This cyber threat from overseas.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, it's like really worrying about terrorism on a daily basis. You're not.
Yeah, I mean,
you're not going to do anything by worrying about it. Yeah,
call your congressman, tell them that this is something that you're concerned about and that you'd like them to invest in, power plants that can't be remote controlled from some dude's botnet operating out of Mongolia. The other thing too is the what was that? Not the power plants. Yeah, I don't remember now. Huh. Yeah, good right. story.
Well, yeah. Anyway, international cybercrime, our personal international man of mystery, Emery, gives us his take on that there. So, and speaking of Emery's take on things, we've got another thing here that you wanted to give your take on.
Yeah, new TV show. Yes. I didn't know about this. There's a show, Kelsey Grammer has a new show. And I guess, after Frasier, he had one show called Hank that wasn't very good. And then there was something else. And then he was the executive producer of Medium.
Oh, was he really?
Yeah, and that was a good show.
Maybe, kind of. That show, real quick tangent here.
Sure.
So that show had like two sets. One of them was the set that was probably 60% of all the shots in that show was the bedroom set. I haven't watched that much of it, but whenever I've watched it, 60% of what I saw was the title character in bed, like either couldn't sleep or had just had a dream they're all these like lazy in bedroom, poorly lit, wake up and oh I'm shocked scenes.
It was a much better show than your MVP.
okay
yeah, that was I promise.
All right, because that was my surface level impression of it.
The new show that Kelsey Grammer has is called Boss. And it is about, it takes place in Chicago, and Kelsey Grammer plays the mayor, and
I could see him as a mayor.
Oh, he nails this role. And he also has like a degenerative disease.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So I don't know like what
his character does, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just wanted to double check.
But I mean, he nails the role. Like, he really plays the part well.
Huh.
I found it to be fantastic. And it's on the Starz website. You can actually watch it, the first episode there.
Is he doing the, is it the kind of Frasier is cluelessly full of himself type mayor, or is he playing a different role?
No. He is a ass-kicking badass.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. And at one point, like, he grabs a dude by the ear, and he puts him down on his knees, and he's, like, screaming at him. And he's, like, you know, gets ready to slap him. And he's, like, twisting this guy, and the guy's, like, crying. It's it's pretty intense. But, like, he's definitely a badass.
Huh. Okay. That sounds like an interesting role for him.
I agree completely. Very, very out of character for Frasier.
Huh. Yeah, yeah. And of course, while you're watching it, you can't help but I'm sure I haven't seen it yet, but I'm guessing you can't help but just think of him as Frasier in that that situation.
There was a couple of moments where I wanted to, but then like I don't know.
He does a good job of differentiating it.
Yeah, it's easy to think of him as Frasier, and it's easy to have him like cast in that role, 'cause that's, you know, the role that he really built his career on. So, I don't know. I think he does a good job. I really suggest you check it out. I think it's a good show.
Okay. And you said online on the, what was it? Stars website?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. You can watch it there. And I don't know if they're going to put all the episodes up or not. Like I said, I've only seen the first one. So,
okay.
Wow. Yeah. And I mean, also this season of Dexter is pretty good too.
Yeah. I actually saw a couple episodes of Dexter a while ago, but they were kind of out of context, but I really liked what I saw. So,
oh yeah. Out of context. That's a show you should start at the beginning on Netflix. I think you'd really like it.
Okay. Yeah.
It's definitely dark.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, I know that,
for people that don't know about the show, it's, gosh, what's the name of the actor? He played, one of the brothers on 6 Feet Under.
Oh really?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I have Google in front of me.
Yeah.
Dexter is Michael C. Hall.
Yes. So yeah. Michael C. Hall plays a blood spatter expert for the Miami-Dade Police Department. Is it Miami-Dade? I think it's Miami-Dade.
I believe so.
And he also happens to be a vigilante serial killer.
It's a good premise. It's a very solid premise.
You're always, yeah, and it really makes you cheer for the bad guy.
Well, it's one of those shows where it's, you know,
they play around with morality a little bit. Yeah,
yeah. You know, like a more serious Leverage.
Yeah,
you're rooting for the bad guys. Yeah,
it's really good. I think that I tried reading one of the books once, and I wasn't really that into it. But
there's books.
Yeah, it's a series of books.
Huh, that the show is based on, or that the...
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Huh.
Yeah, it's kind of like, gosh, what's the other one? True Blood is also based on books, but the books suck.
Well, they're vampire books.
Terrible.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm not necessarily opposed to vampire books. I mean, I'm trying to think of one that I've ever read that I liked, but...
Oh, okay.
I can't think of any.
I was worried you were about to go into, well, I read Twilight, and I didn't think it was too bad.
No, I wouldn't read that. But there's a... my wife likes... gosh darn it. What's her name? Man, we really... I'm clinging to the...
to my ability to Google things today?
Yeah, but... shoot. Never mind. I can't remember.
Right. I can't Google something that that's in your mind.
I've had like a exhausting week.
Oh,
I've
me
had,
too.
I have. Okay, let me put this in context. I have not, however, had a series of interviews with international news organizations. But yeah, I've had a very busy week at work and a lot of home stuff and everything. It's just been pretty rough. And I'm about halfway through this bottle of delicious cider.
Good stuff.
Yeah, it's making me a little drowsy, I guess is the word.
All right. Well, at least at some point, I guess, in the middle of that week, you had Boss to lift your spirits, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it was a good show. I liked it a lot.
Good, good. All right. In the news, sort of, I don't know, something that I found somewhere and you found somewhere completely independent of each other, but we both decided we wanted to talk about it, is this chart someone made of Android orphans. You want to talk about this?
Well, so where to begin? A lot of people have pointed out that, you know, the Android platform versus Apple's iOS, and they say, you know, well, the good thing about Android is that it's open and there's more people that support it and blah, blah, blah. And Apple is, you know, maintains more control and et cetera, et cetera. But one thing that people haven't really been super cognizant of, I don't think, is that there's a lot of what they call fragmentation in the Android space, where there's a lot of variation in the Android operating system that gets deployed by vendors. And I guess to put this kind of in perspective, there's kind of like this old world telco model, and then there's the Apple model. And in the old world telco model, you have the mobile operators control a lot of the content. They sell a lot of the media, the ringtones, and all that stuff, and they've kind of got
that was all fingers. So terrible.
Yeah, they've kind of, you know, they try to get their fingers in all so many pies, and they had this walled garden thing where they would make sure that, like, you know, everything you did was through their web portals and their dopey services and things like that. And also that the operating system software on your handset is something that's directly controlled by them.
And took the opportunity to launch the ringtone browser at any possible opportunity.
Yeah. And not only that, but, like, you know, control branding. So, like, you know, your phone made by Nokia or Motorola would say, like, you know, Verizon when he turned it on, even though, right, sure, you know, it wasn't a Verizon phone. They didn't make it. They just sell it.
Yeah.
But anyway, so there's a lot of these Android handsets that are being abandoned. And this is a problem that's kind of plagued, and I'm specifically making fun of Nokia here, because they've had kind of a, well, they've had a terrible presence in the United States forever, but compared to their European market.
Back in the, you know, the dumb phone days, they were doing all right, but
no, they were never great in the United States. I mean, their world position was always much higher than it was,
right,
in the
United States. Oh, sure. Comparatively,
but,
yes. Yeah.
Yeah. But they have the same problem where after a phone is like 3 to 6 months old, they just stop releasing software for it and they just don't care anymore.
Sure. Yeah. And that's not such a problem for the old, like, dumb phone model, but when you're talking about a smartphone and you've got a bunch of apps that you've got the developers either have to support all these different, yes, operating systems, or everyone has to be on the most modern operating system, it becomes
nothing.
A big issue.
This is one of the biggest wins that Apple ever made in the market, period, in my opinion. Is if you were a Nokia Series 60 or Sony Ericsson Symbian UIQ user, anytime you changed handsets, like you upgraded from like a 6600 to a 6650 or from a P900 to a P910, none of your software worked on the new phone, ever.
Wow.
And every single third-party developer that I ever bought an application from told me to go screw every time I asked, like, a free license because I had just bought it, like, 3 months ago. They're like, yeah, sorry, we don't do that.
Wow.
Like, they all lock their software to the IMEI, like the IMEI, the serial number, yep, of the phone.
Yep.
And that's it. And, like, that's just their standard procedure and their standard practice.
Wow.
And it's terrible. And, like, that business model could not possibly suck any harder for consumers. I'm sure it's great for the developers who get to sell, like,
not necessarily. I mean, there weren't that many people that were buying tons of applications on those phones.
I don't know that. Like, I don't know how big that market was, but it's definitely bigger now.
Well, I guarantee you nowhere near as big as the app market is now. Yeah.
But, you know, long story, like, the long story here, though, is that there's all of this nonsense with these operators that release handsets and release software and then abandon it, you know, a few months later, because they're the party responsible for it and they're terrible at it. Like, they're the worst. And so the problem that's happening right now is there's all these Android devices out there that are no longer able to get current software. And this is not just the operators. This is also Google saying that they're not going to be shipping Android 4 for certain handsets, like the Nexus One.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's kind of a big question there, because, like, Apple, on the other hand, like iOS 5, still runs on the 3GS, right?
iOS 5 runs...
Does it?
Okay.
Yep, yeah. Because my wife has a 3GS. She's running
iOS 5. The 3GS, of course. Yeah, but not the 3G, right?
No.
Okay.
No, yeah. But the 3GS does. And so that's the 3GS, the 4, and the 4S, and the iPad 1 and the iPad 2. That can all run current software. There's only two handsets that Apple released, or two devices. One, the 3G and the original 2G iPhone.
Yes. And the 3G was released in 2008, now that I'm looking at this, which is pretty amazing that that was that long ago.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, because that was the 3G, right? So, like, the original, when was that released?
2007.
Oh.
6/29/2007.
Yeah, that's great. But, yeah, so there's all these Android phones out there, and that's great, but... a lot of them can't run current software and never will.
Well, so, and then this takes us to this visualization that this guy created, right?
Yeah, so there's this great chart that shows you all of the Android phones and what they can and can't run and how long it took for them to get abandoned.
So this guy put a lot of work into this, clearly.
It's a brilliant chart.
There's a whole lot of information encoded in this, and it's a bit difficult to sift through some of it and to sort of understand what's going on, but there's certainly one overriding thing that hits you, which is you've got the all the iPhones are
handsets.
Every iPhone but the iPhone 4 was supported at least 3 years after its release, or into the third year after its release.
And the only reason the iPhone 4 is not in its third year of release is because it hasn't been out for 3 years.
It hasn't been out for 3 years, yeah. and then you've got a bunch of Android phones with varying levels of success. The Nexus One, I guess, is the closest, which is it's almost through its second year after release, and it's still on the current major version. And of course, the Nexus One is the flagship, so... So you would expect that. A few others are doing okay.
It's not going to run the next. It's not going to make it into a third year.
The HTC Droid Incredible is doing okay, and the Evo 4G is doing okay. So
no, well, the Incredible, it says, is possibly still being updated.
Both of those still say possibly still being updated. Yeah.
Verizon's not going to tell you. They don't communicate anything. And then there's, Verizon, see, this is the problem. This is the insidious problem with the operators controlling the firmware, is that they do stupid stuff like, remember how you used to not be able to do Bluetooth tethering with any phone from Verizon, like because they disabled the data profile for everything except for Bluetooth audio?
Okay, yeah.
If you had a Bluetooth phone, some smug jackass like myself with like a Sony Ericsson T68 was like able to get online with my Mac or with my PowerBook at the time through the Bluetooth connection and use my my mobile operator's data service. But someone with a Bluetooth phone from Verizon could barely get a hands-free set to work with it.
Right, yeah.
Because they disabled the ability to do anything else.
Sure, sure. So you get that sort of thing with this fragmentation, and you also get it becomes much, much harder to keep all of these random phones. And this is, I'm sure there are more Android phones than this. These just appear to be the major phones.
A lot of crappy phones out there.
Right, yeah. But you've got all these diverse phones running different hardware being even released at different times, and it's
the HTC Evo 4G is supposed to be like this big baller Android.
Well, it's possibly still being updated.
Hey, bravo. Bravo. It's less than 2 years old. It was released like what, a year ago last summer, and it might still be getting software updates. Like, that's stupid. Like, people are getting screwed.
Yeah. Well, so there is one slightly unfair thing about this chart is that all but one of these Android phones were released in 2009 or later. So you've got the 2008, 2007 iPhones, which look really good because they've had 3 years to prove that they can be updated. So a few of these Android phones might last that long if they completely luck out.
No, they're not.
But it doesn't look likely.
They're not, because they don't have the support from the vendor.
Right, yeah.
Like, the problem is, here's the key difference, right, is that on the iPhone side of the house, Apple controls everything. And while that's a real pain in the neck for some people, they can't get across that, the flip side of this is that Apple does not have to rely on Verizon and Sprint and AT&T engineers to approve firmware updates. They can deliver them over the air. Apple is trying to completely circumvent the mobile operator entirely. And eventually they're going to be completely irrelevant. If you're an iPhone user, you will never have to deal with your cell phone company ever again.
Yep. Yep.
I think that has to be the end game for this. Like, there's no other way around it. And reducing the mobile operators to a dumb utility is the only chance that consumers have to like retain any sanity or control over their own device.
Well, there was some traffic about the rumor of basically extending iMessage to also be iVoice.
Oh, that'd be so awesome.
Yeah, where you just use the data connection for everything, and everything else happens through a cloud service.
That would probably be, if something like that comes out reasonably soon, I would probably be willing to try just using an iPod for a phone.
Okay, yeah. That might work.
I could probably do it now, to be honest. I mean, I would be using Google stuff to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't get that many phone calls. It's mostly text messages, emails, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, the only downside...
And when I do get phone calls, I don't like them. I don't want to be interrupted.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, why are you doing a show with me? That's all I do is interrupt you. But the other side of this, though, is, you know, there's things like Skype, which is great on the iPhone, the iPod, or Android tablets even, I'm sure, have a good experience there. Sure. I think that the Google Voice approach is good. Did you see the Gmail app that was released for like all of 2 hours for iOS this week?
Oh, yeah. And they pulled it because of a notifications bug.
Yeah. And so everyone's like, well, I don't know how I got past Google and Apple. And I'm like, well, I know how I got past Apple. Someone approving the app is like, this app has a bug. Let's, you know.
Let's see how this goes.
Yeah, just go ahead. Approved. Stamp. Send it out the door.
Yep.
It's almost as bad as like those idiots at Symantec that can't do a whole disk encryption without bricking people's MacBooks. Did you see that?
No.
Oh, these guys cannot. Apparently, no one at Symantec can like afford the $99 developer access from Apple, because every single OS update that comes out, everybody that uses PGP whole disk encryption that installs the software update bricks their machine.
Wow, that's terrible.
Those guys are idiots. Ugh. And like they also have the worst antivirus software too. Like, it is an absolute disaster.
I've never had a good or bad experience with it, but that's mostly because I've never extensively used antivirus software anyway. But
I don't mind the Symantec endpoint protection on Windows. I think it's pretty decent there. But and, you know, there's probably going to be people that strongly disagree with that. But on the Mac, it is absolutely terabad. And the only antivirus there's two that I would recommend people use on the Mac. One is the freeware Clam AV. Which was recently bought by SourceFire. An open source project, but they have a pretty good GUI for that, and they have a nice finer integration, so you can like right click on a folder and say, you know, scan this folder, and it'll tell you all the Windows viruses that are there. And but if you want like something a little bit more complete with real time protection, Sophos.
Oh wow!
For the Mac is quite good.
Ah, that's the one Stanford recommends. Huh.
Yeah, Sophos is good.
Yeah. Cool.
But yeah, Symantec antivirus for the Mac is a total train wreck. And whoever the product manager is for whole disk encryption at PGP, a Symantec company, they're bad too. I don't know why they can't get that right.
All right, you better hope they're not one of our dozen listeners.
I don't care. F them. Like, that's terrible.
Yep.
Like, bricking computers left and right.
That is inexcusable.
Yeah. That's dumb. And then they don't send out like a notification. Like, if you go to the Symantec forums, there's like so many people that are just completely freaking out. Sure. And they're like, you know, why didn't you tell us? Blah, blah, blah. And it's like, you know, the obvious answer is, if you're an enterprise user, you don't install software updates willy-nilly.
Yep.
And I think Symantec assumes that that's how people are deploying this product. But there's this big trend right now in enterprise IT where people are kind of being allowed to supply their own hardware. Because, you know, some of it's like a cost-saving measure because they don't want to have to provision a new phone for everybody. So if someone already has an iPhone, they're like, well, okay, we have ActiveSync on Exchange, and we'll go ahead and let you attach your phone to Exchange. And that way, we don't have to buy a phone for you. And that's actually something that's been happening quite a bit in, like, healthcare, enterprise, and higher education. It's a pretty big trend. And then there's also, like, kind of this self-service IT that some people are picking up on too, where they're like, instead of having like a standard hardware build that everyone gets, they could say, well, you know, you have an allowance of $1,200 and whatever you buy for $1,200 is fine with us.
Wow, that's nice.
However, I think this is probably where companies like Symantec that are not especially agile and do not respond well to trends and changes in their market are not able to kind of keep up with that. So I think that's probably one of the contributing factors there.
Huh. All right. Coming back to this Android thing for just a moment before we move on, my favorite part of this whole graphic, the Garmin phone. It's not actually, it's not terrible. I mean, if there are worse things on this chart as far as updates go than the Garmin phone, but
wow,
you just gotta love the Garmin phone.
I think it's a great name.
I mean,
it's a strong branding.
They originally had the Garmin Nuvi phone because all their GPSs were the Nuvi 360. I owned one of those. I did. Yeah, it was a nice GPS. I used it right up until I got a phone that had GPS in it. yeah.
Yeah, there was a I had a Garmin GPS a long time ago. It was the Garmin eMap.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Those were solid.
Yeah. Loved it.
Yeah. No, I mean, Garmin makes really solid GPS units.
I've been thinking about picking one up for the car, but then you were saying that I should check out the, what's the navigation software you like?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a couple navigation, pieces of navigation software for the iPhone. The one I use is Navigon, N-A-V-I-G-O-N, and it's quite good.
I'll check it.
It's got a little bit of the, it kind of holds over some legacy issues from GPS software in general. You know, namely, like, all of their point of interest databases are straight up, like, you'd get on a normal GPS, you don't have a nice, you know, Google search-like thing. Yeah. Although they do actually have a Google local search API thing where you just type in a field and it does a Google local search, which is pretty nice.
Can I just say, though, that one of the reasons I think it'd be nice to have a Garmin Nuvi is because I like that you can get, like, celebrity voices.
Oh, yes. Although, actually, that's not Garmin. That is TomTom.
I think both of them do it.
Oh, does Garmin do it now? Really?
I think so. Because, you know, to be honest, I think it'd be great to have Snoop Dogg give you directions. I think that would be amazing.
So what would be great would be if they actually did a full, if they could actually model the person's voice so they could have them speaking names as well.
Hey, wait, don't they have one for Jeremy Clarkson from Top Gear?
Oh, I'm sure they do. That'd be fantastic.
Can you imagine? That would be hilarious.
That'd be great.
Yeah, I'd love to see that. But yeah, I think that's really one of the, like, to be fair, to be completely honest, I think that's probably the main reason I would want one. So maybe it's not really
you could probably find all those audio files online somewhere. And
yeah, but then what am I going to do, like, make a disc and shuffle them in the car?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I
once knew someone that burned a bunch of high-end audio recordings of engine rev noises of Ferraris, you know, revving up their engines and whatever.
That's awesome.
and would throw that in their CD player, turn up their speakers real loud.
That's actually I should try that.
Yeah,
I would like to do that.
It'll make you feel really good about your car real quick.
Well, I mean, I guess it really depends on what the sound is. Could we get, like, maybe like a locomotive?
Yep.
Or like a diesel truck. That'd be awesome too.
You roll up to someone at the stoplight, pull down the window.
That hasn't happened to me in a while.
Yep.
So tell me about this Kindle lending library thing.
Here, all right. Big news. Big news this week. You know how, you know what I qualify as big news? Why this is big news?
Why is it big news, Alan?
It's on the Amazon homepage. Anything that's on the Amazon homepage is big news in my book.
That is big news.
They have that power. All they have to do is put this note from Jeff Bezos on the Amazon homepage, and whatever they put there is big news. They should just post random things to hear every once in a while. Dear customers,
I recently
pie. Thanks.
I used to, usually what I do when I buy stuff from Amazon is my wife has an education account, so she's been having free Prime.
Oh, nice.
So I usually buy everything through that. But this week, I've been building a new computer following your lead, and I've been ordering a lot of the parts off of Amazon and Newegg. And I got your case. I got the silver one. I don't know what color yours was.
You got the case. Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, mine is Design R3.
Mine is black. It is such a nice case. Oh, it's fantastic.
I like it. I put my power supply in and the optical drive. I bought a Blu-ray burner and they tossed in when I popped my CPU cooler. Because, you know, if you're building a computer, you also need to get, like, these big clamp things that, like, keep your computer from melting. And this power supply I got, though, this is hilarious. I should take a picture when I have it open again tomorrow. But I got an 800-watt power supply. And it has, like, a Medusa-like cluster of serpents streaming forth from it.
Did you get the one that I got? The Corsair HX Professional Series?
I don't know. Mine says gaming something, and it's
800. Oh, okay. All right. No, mine's not that.
Multicolored lights that you can turn on and off.
Wow. That is...
This stuff is...
Whenever you get anything that is labeled as gaming, you know, it's going to have some sort of ridiculous light.
Well, you can turn it off. There's a switch on the back, so you can cycle it between three different colors or leave it off.
Right.
But yeah, I got all that, and then I ordered my CPU. I got an i7 and a metric ass load of RAM and a pretty posh video card. So, I'm waiting for that to come in, and then I start the work this weekend.
Nice.
But I went ahead and upgraded myself to Amazon Prime, mainly because they offered it to me for free. But it looks like it may not have been a bad idea, huh?
Yes. So Amazon Prime is getting primier thanks to this new feature, which they call the Kindle Owner's Lending Library, which sounds a little ridiculous. But the idea is they have a selection of books that you can borrow for free if you're an Amazon Prime member.
Oh.
And I couldn't quite tell. They haven't really... I haven't been able to find the exact sort of terms of how all the borrowing works yet. And I haven't tried it myself yet. I think it's actually active
right
now.
Doesn't it depend on the publisher to also give permission?
So, yeah. I mean, it's a select... a subgrouping of books, so it's not the whole Kindle library by any means. I don't see a number here, but it's somewhere on the order of maybe a couple hundred books, something like that. A lot of bestsellers, a lot of popular books. It's not like they're giving away a bunch of Project Gutenberg ports for free or something.
Wow. My very own copy of Sung Tzu's The Art of War.
Well, with a name like the Kindle Owner's Lending Library, you might expect it to be a bunch of, bunch of classics. But it's fairly recent books here from what I'm seeing, a lot of stuff that is anywhere from $4 to $15 to actually buy, which is, it's a cool feature. It's not... I don't think going to sell anyone on Amazon Prime. You're not, even if you've already got a Kindle, you're probably not going to buy Amazon Prime just to be able to borrow one book a month. Since Amazon Prime is like, I think $6 or $7 a month anyway. So that's, I mean, you could just buy the book, right?
Yeah.
But it's one of those nice additional features, kind of like video on demand, actually. I mean, I was already an Amazon Prime member because I like the 2-day shipping, and then the video on demand is just icing on the cake. So this is a little drop of candy on top of that icing or something.
Sure.
Anyway, I think it's pretty cool, though. I intend to try it out at some point in the near future. I'm hoping it is. So they say it's like one book a month, or they said up to one book a month. And I'm wondering if that is you can only borrow one book per month, but then you get to keep borrowing that book until you're finished reading it, or if it is you can only borrow one book at a time and you can only switch the book that you're borrowing once a month, or if it is you can only borrow one book at a time but you can switch it out as much as you want. I'm not sure which of those three it actually is. I'll give it a try and potentially report back. And they say no due dates, actually. I'm reading it here. So they say as frequently as a book a month with no due dates. I'm not sure exactly what borrowing terms that actually translates into. So,
who's to say?
Yeah, but it seems like a cool feature.
It'll probably change too. I mean, they seem to be. Amazon definitely likes to get something out there and then kind of refine it as they go, right?
Yeah, yeah.
This will be good for them, I think.
Yeah, and it sounds like it may not have been too much of a stretch for publishers, because they apparently have already been making deals with publishers where it's like a sort of Netflix style, we'll pay you this much per year or whatever, and to have these books available. And it doesn't matter how many copies of the book they actually sell, it's just to have these books available to sell on the Kindle store, they pay a flat fee. So if they already had deals like that in place, you can imagine it's not so much of a stretch to go on to renting. So,
sure.
Yep. And it makes perfect sense, renting books on the Kindle platform, because...
I agree. That's fantastic, in my opinion.
And actually, this isn't really renting. It's lending, because it's supposedly free, although the Prime membership does cost. But I actually would not mind... And would not be surprised if they did offer something like a buy this book for $8, rent it for a month for $2 or something like that.
Hmm.
That could work. Anyway, another interesting move with regard to Amazon Prime.
Do you think households can share those accounts?
I don't think so, unless they are already sharing if they're sharing a single Amazon account,
then they already have everything anyways.
But I'm guessing, I mean, they can still only check out one book at a time anyway, I'm guessing. So
I don't know how, I'm curious how prevalent that is, because like I know that a lot of people with iOS devices like iPads and iPhones and iPods, like they have like, you know, one account that they all kind of like share, so they buy an application once and get it on all their devices, or buy a book once, and I don't know if that's, I mean, it's technically, you know, allowed in the terms of service, like you have this many devices, and
I think
it's designed specifically for households like that, but
I'm guessing if you borrow a book, it's probably just like buying a book in that you can then download it to any of your devices.
Okay.
So if you're, and I don't know this for certain, but I'm guessing, because that's the way all the other Amazon book DRM works.
Yeah, see, there's this other part of this though where, like on the iOS side, I'm starting to feel like there's a lot of times where there's applications for iOS that I've bought and that Liz also bought.
Sure, yeah.
You know, so like there's a lot of things that we've like bought multiple copies of over the years, and on the Kindle, not so much, and we have different reading tastes, but we definitely have different Amazon accounts. You know, like I'm curious if they're going to kind of embrace that and be like, okay, like, because Apple in particular, with the being able to merge accounts, like there's a lot of people that have multiple Apple IDs and they don't really have a way for end users to combine them.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So there's like this whole pain in the neck about that. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how they're going to sort that out. And I don't really know what the recommendation should be. We should talk about that on a future show.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if anyone is positioned to take on that problem, it's probably Amazon, because they probably do get a fair amount of families sharing accounts and, you know, with one credit card or with multiple Kindles on one account or that sort of stuff. So
yeah, right.
Yeah. So I'm sure they are aware of it. That would be an interesting move. It would be a cool thing to see. So
I agree.
All right. Well, I think that will probably do it for this episode of the Hell Yeah Show. Episode 13, the spooky episode, was supposed to be the Halloween episode.
Yeah.
That would have been good. Episode 13 on Halloween. That would have been great.
On the 31st, too. It's a palindrome.
Yeah. Is it
a
13 on the 31st? Yep. Yes, it is. Yeah.
Okay.
So, well, I mean, yeah.
I'm not an educated man.
1331. Yes. So.
Yeah. And did you see that the 11-11 or 11-1-11 was this week also?
Yes. Yeah. And then 11-11-11 is coming up very soon.
That's going to be awesome.
It's going to be great because The Elder Scrolls Skyrim is being released on 11-11-11.
Oh.
Yeah. Looking forward to that.
All right.
All right. Very good. If you want to contact us, you can do so via email. All you have to do is shoot an email to show@hellyeah.com, or you can visit our website at show.hellyeah.com. And as Emery likes to say,
on the Twitter machine, you can find us at twitter.com/hellyeahshow, or send us a message at hellyeahshow.
All right. Very good. Other than that, we will see you next week.
He's not the Alan Joyce you hate.